This is Reach Out in the Darkness, and I am your host, Ruth Newman. And today we are here with Kyle Ellison, who has a story to tell us from his years working in the Kentucky prison system. And I guess I'll just start out by asking you, how did you get involved in working for the prison system?
Well, after I got out of the Army in 1972, I got a job in Louisville as a probation and parole officer working with adults. And after 9 years of doing that, I went out to become a personnel trainer. So I trained staff for the prisons and probation and parole and jails statewide. So during that time, I prepared various lesson materials, everything from suicide prevention and report writing to firearms and mental health issues. Whatever management wanted, I did. And one of the things I volunteered for was to do a one-hour block of instruction on the history of the prisons in Kentucky. This sounded really interesting, and this turned out to be something that's been interesting for half my life now.
Just for starters, could you tell me what the difference is between probation and parole?
Parole is when the inmate has been released early and reports to a parole officer. Probation is the offender has not been sentenced to prison, but that is being held over his head in case he acts bad again, and then he would go before the judge. So probation is you be on your best behavior or you have this sentence waiting for you.
I see. So you worked for the Kentucky prison system as a probation officer, is that right?
Probation. I did probation and parole both.
And how long?
Well, I did that 9 years.
9 years. And during what years?
1972 to 1981.
Before they became a state and there was no prison system, what did they do? How did they punish criminals?
Well, the penalty for most felonies at that time was death. So just to have a prison system was considered a major humanitarian good. It was a good deed to even have a state prison, and Kentucky opened up its prison in 1800. It was the first state penitentiary west of the Allegheny Mountain.
What were some of the problems that they were facing back in the 1800s?
Uh-huh. I mean, the crimes at the time were different. Horse stealing was a big crime then.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the penalty for stealing horses had been death. So now, I think the first prisoner went there for horse stealing. And so by around 1820, the prison was overcrowded, and the keeper is what they called him, was asking for more money. And this continued to be problematic, and the legislature, just like today, really didn't really want to spend more money.
Uh-huh.
And so along comes a private businessman named Joel Scott, who makes a proposal that sounds too good to pass up. He just tells the state, well, let's make a deal. If you lease me the entire penitentiary and the inmate labor, I will control everything. I will work the inmates, and from their labor, I will not only take care of the prisoners, but I will return money to the state so that I will run this so well that the state will make money instead of having to spend money.
And so this was called the leasing system.
Yes, this came to be known as the lease system. There were various laws passed that formalized this up into the 1850s, but the lease system basically continued this way up until around 1881. And these lessees, they were called, were very politically powerful people who were elected by the legislature. So this was like one of the most plum jobs possible to get, and the lessee, his residence was right across the street from the penitentiary, and the governor lived right down just a block away. So these were very powerful people, and they used the money that they made to try to make sure that they would be elected to another term.
And how did they make all of this money? I have a note here that between 1834 and 1844, one of the lessees, Thomas Theobald, made over $200,000. How did they make that money off of prisoners?
This was a terrific amount of money for that day. And so the prisoners did every kind of labor-intensive job you can imagine. One of the main industries at that time in Kentucky was hemp. And hemp required a lot of manual labor because you had to break the hemp and break it up so that you could weave it. And hemp was woven into the backs of rugs, and it made rope. One of the primary uses of hemp was that they wove it into the fibers of cotton bags, and this meant you could hold twice as much weight in the bag. So they sold these all over. But inmates made lots of different things. They did blacksmithing work. They made nails and chain and things like that.
I have another note that said in 1857, three inmates cut off their hands just so that they could avoid working in the hemp fields.
Well, this wasn't the hemp fields. This was the hemp house, what they call the hemp house, which was, it was a building within the penitentiary walls. And this is where a lot of the breaking took place. If you do this indoors, this is extremely dusty. This is almost impossible to breathe in an environment like that. And so if people didn't work hard enough, they just simply beat them. They whipped them. This was very common. Whipping continued to be used right up into the early 30s.
So in other words, this was slave labor. It was forced labor, and they had no compensation for it.
That's right. And by and large, the more money that the lessee spent on meeting inmate needs, like food, sewage, sanitation, clean water, medical care, clothing, heating for the cell houses, the more money that the lessee spent on the inmates, the less money he made. There was every incentive there to increase profits by shortchanging the needs of the inmates. And of course, the state made attempts to police this and inspect this, but it turns out that that really wasn't very effective because the state inspectors were subject to the legislature, and the legislature was under control of the moneyed interests that were helping them be reelected, the lessee. So these lessees knew how to oil their political machine. The lessee Theobald made a lot of money, but sometimes lessees didn't make money. For example, there were years where there were fires in the penitentiary, and so some of the buildings, or maybe even a cell house, would catch on fire. And so the lessee, probably by the contract, should have been responsible to pay for this, but generally the legislature picked up the slack when things went wrong, and the lessee got the good parts but not the bad parts.
So there is every motivation to get more and more inmates for the lessee so that he would have more labor, and there was more and more motivation on the part of the legislators to give the lessee what they wanted, because in return they were given money for their campaigns. Is that right?
Right. The last lessee, his name was Jeremiah South. Jeremiah South was known as the father of Breathitt County. He was a very powerful and astute political operator. And under his lesseeship, things got incredibly awful.
And when was that?
Well, he was the last lessee, and he died in office around 1881. And that's how they were able to end the lease system. He actually died in the legislative chambers. He was sick when he went there. The inmate death rate was extremely high under his tutelage. And it's interesting, you would bring up, you know, the number of inmates. It was to the advantage to have more inmates. I would just make the example that during the Civil War, they had the lease system, but right after the Civil War, the prison population skyrocketed. It just went up immensely quickly, and of course, a substantial number of these inmates were African-American inmates. Mm-hmm. And this was at the time the only prison that Kentucky had. This was in Frankfort, and so they were used as slaves.
Mm-hmm. An alternative way that they figured out to get slaves after slavery was outlawed?
Well, you could certainly see it that way. And this sort of thing took various forms, particularly in county jails throughout the South primarily, mm-hmm. where young African-American men might be rounded up around harvest time, charged with something insubstantial, given a real high bond, and then given a choice to stay in jail or work for the local farmers. There have been things done about this. One is a book that's been written called Slavery by Another Name, which is also a video. So this was not an uncommon practice. So it's not just the Kentucky State Penitentiary that did things like this, but the inmates were definitely not very well taken care of.
Yeah, I have a quote from the Courier Journal back in 1873, where it says that Kentucky is the only state where convicts are sold into, quote, absolute slavery, unquote.
I don't know if Kentucky was the only state, but Kentucky certainly did this longer than most states under the lease system. So one thing I did want to mention about the lease system is that in 1860, the prison physician, Dr. William Sneed, wrote a legislative document, which is really a more like a book. It's hundreds of pages long. It's the history of the state penitentiary. He was very progressive for his time and saw the weaknesses of the lease system. And it is because Sneed wrote this book in 1860, which is available in the Free Public Library downtown, by the way. Because he wrote this book, we know what we know that happened between 1800 and 1860. If he hadn't written it, we probably wouldn't have this. I mean, he picked through the rubbish of the records, he says in his preface. And one of the things he says in this history, he says the lease system was the engine of political ambition and the pest house of moral corruption.
How about that?
And I thought that was just a classic statement from his part. There are several things that are fortuitous about the Kentucky prison history. One is that the prison at Frankfort was built down in a valley, which means we have pictures of it from looking down into the penitentiary. And the other is that Sneed did this history in 1860. And that's why we know what happened, and we have photographic records that are beyond what other states have. I don't know any other state, really, that built a prison down in the valley like Kentucky did.
Huh.
And this turned out not to be a good place for a prison when the 1937 flood came.
So I wanted to go from the lease system, which ended in 1880, I believe.
Around 80 or 81.
And what did we go into after that?
What happened then was that there was a warden that was nominally in charge of the prison, but then things were worked under what was called the contract system. And under this system, inmates were leased out to private contractors. So if you were a big corporation, you could make a bid that you would pay the state so much per day per inmate. And then you could get, say, 100 inmates, and you could take those inmates out, and you could build railroads with them. Or you could mine coal, and you could build railroad tunnels, and anything that they wanted to use them for. And I thought for a long time that these would be just local companies that would come in and do this. Mm-hmm. But one of the main contractors was the C.R. Mason Company, who specialized in building railroads. And so this right during the 1870s and 80s where railroads were the thing that was being built. And so C.R. Mason came and they got the main contract to lease out the inmates. Well, C.R. Mason came from Virginia and they had been building railroads in Virginia. So C.R. Mason comes to Kentucky, gets the contract and proceeds to use the inmates to build railroads around eastern Kentucky, around Winchester and Mount Sterling, and build railroad tunnels. One of the things the inmates did during that time is it might not have been under the C.R. Mason Company, they subcontracted. So there were all these business deals. So one group of inmates built a part of the waterworks in Lexington, Kentucky. And I have a picture of that. They all appear to be African-American inmates. It's not a great picture, but I got that from the water company itself. Mm-hmm. Another project that the inmates built that is visible today is a railroad tunnel that ran under the lodge at Natural Bridge State Park. That tunnel is still there, although it's at one entrance it's caved in. But that tunnel was built with inmate labor. And several of the inmates, at least half a dozen of them who died in the process, are buried up on the hillside someplace above the lodge. So inmates were used, they were taken out to labor camps and kept in these camps. And the state went out to inspect these camps, but even when they found conditions that were inadequate, there was not the political will there to call the contractors to account. The inmates suffered greatly under this. This was worse than slavery, because at least with slavery, somebody owned that property. I mean, people were property as slaves. Inmates didn't even have the standing of being property. Nobody owned the inmates. So why would anybody care for something that they didn't own? So the death rates were immensely high. The injury rates were high. The conditions were absolutely miserable. And there were several incidents wherein there were hearings and trials held because some of these private contractors had beaten an inmate to death unnecessarily. In fact, one of them was the same guy that did it in two different locations. But these people weren't really punished. And so this continued, this what was called the contract system continued clear up until the new state constitution came about around 1891. And that outlawed the working of the inmates outside the penitentiary walls. And it was probably convenient that by that time a lot of the railroads had been built. Inmates were also used to mine coal. One interesting story is that Biederman DuPont, one of the DuPont family, owned one of the Louisville papers called the Louisville Commercial. And his rival was Henry Watterson, who owned the Times or the Courier, whatever they called it then. And so DuPont got a contract to use inmates to mine coal around Central City, Kentucky. And the miners and free laborers in Muhlenberg County area didn't take to this well. And so there was a big political uproar, and the net result was that the inmates were forced to go back to the penitentiary at Frankfort. And then Biederman DuPont did this again in Whitley County, and the miners gathered around the convict labor camp and threatened to burn it down. And the governor, Proctor Knox, sent the state militia down there with a Gatling gun to protect the convict labor camp from being destroyed by the miners. So Governor Proctor Knox sent the state militia down there to Whitley County so that the miners wouldn't destroy the inmate labor camp and the miners could keep mining coal. The leader of that group was General Castleman, that same Castleman that where the statue is in the Highlands that is so controversial. General George Castleman was the leader of the state militia that went down there to defend the convict labor camp. During what we've talked about so far, inmates didn't get paid. So after 1891 or two, it became, under the new state constitution that was passed then, I think it was 1891, it became illegal to sell the inmates outside the penitentiary walls, and so the inmates were forced to stay inside the walls of the prison itself. So this was better, but it didn't turn out to necessarily be a lot better, but it was certainly better than the hundreds of inmates who died or were maimed by the working conditions that had gone on before. What happened was is that major companies, and some of these were multi-state corporations, moved factories inside the walls of the penitentiary.
And they were given permission to do that by the state government.
Yes, the state had a warden, and the warden was in charge, and we didn't have an they didn't lease the inmates to the outside contractors anymore. They just leased the inmates to the corporations that had factories within the prison walls. And this was very labor intensive stuff this would work well. This was like the birth of the Industrial Revolution here, kind of. And so the idea of having an assembly line was starting to become used. And so they set up operations, and they were able to make like 14,000 shirts a week at a prison. Well, you know, the factory that owned these shirts was probably the Sterling Reliance Company out of Chicago that owned factories in prisons in maybe 10 different states. They had one of their operations was in the state penitentiary in what we now call the Colgate-Palmolive building was Indiana's penitentiary right across the river in Clarksville.
How about that?
And so they were able to make shirts and shoes and brooms and horse collars and chairs. These were the major labor-intensive things. And so like the largest horse whip and horse collar company east of the Mississippi was in the state penitentiary at that time called the Branch Penitentiary at Eddyville, Kentucky. And so people that were trying to make a living making chairs, shoes, shirts, any of these things were put out of business. And so inmates did start to be paid during this period of time a mere pittance, just because they were able to make more money if they paid them a little bit. It was a means to control the inmates. But there were also careful logs kept of how many lashes were dispensed to the inmates who refused to work or didn't work fast enough. There were, let's just say, they did not spare the lash. I mean, these inmates were tied down across what looked like a sawhorse and whipped with a leather strap on a stick. And if the women inmates refused to work, they whipped them too.
And did this also include children?
No. Probably some of the inmates were very young, unacceptably young by today's standards. And there really wasn't a separate juvenile institution until Kentucky Village, a state juvenile institution until Kentucky Village opened up in around the turn of the century, around 1898 or 1900. So some of the people sent to the inmates were clearly people that would be much too young to be incarcerated in an adult prison, but that was not the majority.
What about other ways that prisoners died? You mentioned there was no medical care in the prisons, and I've got a fact about going back now to 1891, 48% of inmates died of tuberculosis.
Yes, there were certainly serious outbreaks of tuberculosis and cholera, and
tied up also connected to overcrowding.
Yes, it didn't help that they didn't want to spend the money to make sure that the penitentiary wasn't contaminated with sewage, and so. There were large numbers of inmates who were really, really sick, especially under the governorship of Luke Blackburn, who was elected governor in 1881. Luke Blackburn was a big reformer for his day. During his time in office, he pardoned almost 800 inmates. Some of them were too sick to walk out of the prison. Luke Blackburn was considered a great reformer for his day, and he certainly was. And today, one of the minimum security prisons in Kentucky is named after him. It's called Blackburn Correctional Complex. And you can clearly see this from Interstate 64 as you're driving east, right about the very first time you see a sign for Interstate 75. It's Blackburn Correctional Complex. And it is the old Kentucky Village. And so he is honored in that way.
I have some notes also that throughout the years, there were various governors and governor commissions that recommended more money be spent to improve conditions in the prisons and to improve overcrowding. And that it was always voted down by the General Assembly.
This is not unlike some of the issues that we have today. The state wasn't really able to monitor the activities of the private people who were running the system under these various forms that we've talked about. And the legislators that were progressive and did make proposals and did do research and investigations were not able to get their agendas passed because the inmates had no real advocate. So this is why a high percentage of the inmates died, particularly in the 1870s, under the last of the lessee years that Jeremiah South had them. I can't remember the exact numbers, but maybe 20% of the inmates died, maybe more. I mean, there was a very high percentage of the inmates at that time, something that would be totally unacceptable by today's standards, but seemed to just fall off the radar back then because nobody cared.
Nobody cared. And they had things called dry holes.
Inmates who acted out. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps they assaulted a guard, or maybe worse, they were put into small places in the dark. They would sometimes call them a dark hole or a dry hole. A dry hole would just be that there was no running water in there. And the dark hole would be that there were no windows. And so this would be a small room that might well be totally dark. And the inmate would be left in there for various periods of time and fed bread and water, and that was it. This, of course, drives people insane. I mean, today we know the effects of solitary confinement. Other times, inmates were punished in other horrifying ways. They would handcuff an inmate to the cell bars in the punishment unit, and they'd handcuff one hand up high and one hand down low, so it would be uncomfortable. And they would just leave the inmate there all day long. They wouldn't let him down to use the toilet, so you can see where that went. And at the end of the day, they would let him down and feed him bread and water, and this was just another form of the punishment. Mm-hmm. So inmates, they had incentive to work.
Mm-hmm. So, but it didn't really work as any kind of a deterrent, did it? Because the prison populations kept exploding throughout the years. Is that right, in Kentucky?
Well, the prison population kept going up and up, and it climbed through the 20s, and more money was made by using inmates to make these products, which were shipped all over the United States. Mm-hmm. Union labor was in a frenzy about this, mm-hmm. by the way. There were, if you look up under United States Department of Labor, convict labor, you can see there are hundreds and hundreds of pages of transcribed testimony before the United States Congress in the 19-teens and in the 20s, where union labor is rightly upset. Slave laborers, in effect, are taking the jobs of free mm-hmm. workers. Coal miners were better organized and could get it stopped, but so it was the garment workers union, the shoemakers union, and other groups like that did that. And so there was incentive to have more inmates to work. And this went on up until the early 1930s. And what happened then is Congress passed what was called the Hawes-Cooper Act. It's more complicated than this, but to simplify it, it made it much more difficult to sell inmate-made goods across a state line. It allowed each state to set up its own tax barriers to keep out inmate-made goods. This happened right about the same time as the Great Depression. And so inmate factories that had been working thousands of men, and if you look up the annual reports from those years, some of them are in the Louisville Free Public Library, they have listings of how much money was made and where that money went. And the companies that did is this part of the annual reports. And so during these years, particularly the 19-teens, around 1910 to 1915, these private companies paid the best photographers at the time to go in and take pictures of their operations. These are the best quality photographs and records that we have of the prison system. It's because these private people brought in the state-of-the-art photography mm-hmm. for the day and mm-hmm. took those pictures. And they took pictures of other things, not just the factories. So, but that was primarily, I think, the result of that. And some of those pictures are in the annual reports of those years. Anyway, to jump back into the 1930s, so now it becomes unprofitable to have inmate labor because you can't sell things made out of state. So the state, this happened in other states as well, turned to this what's called the state use system. This means anything made by inmates has to be used within the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So people generally associate making license plates with that, and that was certainly part of that, but that wouldn't employ but maybe 25 or 35 inmates. You know, there's this rush, well, what are you going to do to employ these inmates? Well, there wasn't really any money to invest right then. Mm-hmm. So instead of working, inmates were marched around in military drills. Inmates, of course, did the majority of the labor to keep the prison running, the laundry, the cooking, the cleaning, etc., which is true today also. But the inmates that weren't involved in that were taken out and marched around in military drill. And so all of a sudden you had all this idleness in the prisons. You had the places where there'd been factories were just now big day rooms. And also during this time, the prison population continued to really grow and grow and grow. This was the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so by 1935, you had 3,000 inmates at the prison at Frankfort. And this was a space that was inside the wall, was not much bigger than 4 acres. So things were so crowded during this time that the inmates hardly could get out of the way so that the floor could be swept. And because of my position as a personnel trainer, I was able to have contact with the 2,000 prison employees at that time, and I passed out information, and all those people knew that I was looking for the prison history, and they would call me. And so because of that, I was able to track down 4 men who had worked as guards at the prison at Frankfort in the 1930s, and I interviewed those people. And so that's how I know that there were so many men that they could hardly even sweep the floor. And there are some photographs of that time. But the bottom line was that this was a major, major catastrophe. And in the middle of all that comes the 1937 flood. This was just a disaster beyond what could be comprehended. There are lots of stories how that the inmates were left in their cells to drown. None of that was true. The inmates were let out of the lower cells. The inmates essentially tore the prison apart. I mean, the guards were certainly not able to control the prison. The men got into the women's section of the prison. It was in a separate place, but the men figured out how to get over there. The inmates got floating whiskey barrels, heated them up and extracted the alcohol. Some of the inmates got up in one of the guard boxes and got control of the weapons up there. They were talked down. Governor Chandler himself, Happy Chandler, got out there at the prison. It was by now called the State Reformatory, not the penitentiary.
Now you're talking about Frankfort.
This is all at Frankfort. Governor Chandler got out there in hip waiter boots and supervised the evacuation of the prison. And these inmates were taken to jails and other institutions all over the state.
But wondering about the Colgate palm olive.
There's interesting stories about how the inmates at the Indiana Penitentiary or Reformatory there at the Colgate building were used to do sandbags and fight floods around 1913. By the way, that prison was closed in the early 1920s, and those inmates were moved to Pendleton, Indiana, or to Michigan City, Indiana, and that's roughly when Colgate took over.
I see. And I also have in my notes that staffing was terrible throughout the 1800s and early 1900s, that back in 1928, prison guards worked 12-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week shifts, and only got 14 days vacation through the whole year.
Well, these were state employees, and they were out of sight and out of mind just as the inmates were.
Just as the inmates were.
Staffing is a problem today. Mm-hmm. Just getting enough staff is a major issue right now at the Kentucky State Reformatory.
You know, and I'm also wondering, from what I was reading, most of the legislative concern was with giving the prisoners weekly sermons, but there wasn't any regard for any kind of rehabilitation or improvement of conditions. When did any kind of rehabilitation efforts take hold, do you know?
Well, the first thing they did to affect rehabilitation is they just changed the names to protect the guilty. So in 1912, the state penitentiary at Frankfort became known as the State Reformatory, and the branch penitentiary at Eddyville, which was opened up around Christmas Day, 1889, the branch penitentiary was then called the penitentiary. So they changed the names to make it sound more progressive. That was the end of it right there. You know, there were efforts made to give the inmates religion. Crime was seen as a moral failure. And so there was great emphasis on making sure the inmates could go to church. Mm-hmm. And there were services, and there are interesting photographs of some of those services through the years, starting around 1910 when the photographs were made. So the idea that inmates would learn to read was certainly there early on in the 19-teens. There were what was called night schools, and they would have these schools in wherever they could, maybe in the cell house corridors. And so there was effort made to teach the inmates to learn to read. And annual reports list the inmates, that how many of them are illiterate, how many of them are drinkers, how many of them did this and that and the other, what county they're from. There's just endless information, as if somebody's going to be able to use all these minutiae facts to determine what is going on and how we can cure these inmates. But the religious aspect and the educational aspect were certainly the major things at the time. And they didn't really have the room for it. Then they didn't have the money to do it. But after the 1937 flood, the construction started on what was called the state reformatory at LaGrange. Governor Chandler had clearly seen the dire straits that the penitentiary at Frankfort was in, or the reformatory at Frankfort at that time, in the 30s when he was governor. He had the land out at LaGrange already under contract prior to the flood of 1937. So within 90 days of the flood and the evacuation, Governor Chandler had inmates working towards building the new state reformatory at LaGrange. And so this was considered to be a great progressive step, because it would be 10 times bigger than the prison at Frankfort, and they had the chance to do vocational training, and they built facilities for that. So that is when the reformatory was built and why it was built out there. And one reason that it was built there is because they had 3,000 acres, and so it was thought that the inmates would farm. Farming was more of an occupation then for more people than it is now. So that's why the prison went up out there, and it officially opened up around 1939. I have a picture of opening day. You know, there are thousands of people gathered around. Everybody's excited. So after the reformatory opened, World War II started. And in general, the prison inmate population decreased some and really stayed pretty much the same up until around 1970. So by 1970, there were less than 4,000 inmates. Mm-hmm. So the whole prison population was actually fewer people in 1970 than there were in the late 30s.
And what do you attribute that to?
I think it might have something to do with the fact that nobody was making money off having the inmates. So, and also the war, and then after the war, the economic boom of the 50s. And then during the 60s was the Vietnam War, and there was an economic boom then. Mm-hmm. And so times were good then, and there was lots of work. And I don't think we had the income, the range of income disparity that we have today. Those are all reasons and interesting ideas that I think should be investigated more. I mean, people say that, that the inmate population is not connected to economic conditions, but it seemed to me that there's at least circumstantial evidence that it is. There were serious reform efforts in the 1960s under Corrections Commissioner Joe Cannon. He stayed around a couple of years, and they got rid of him. And then in the early 70s, when I started to work, there was Chuck Holmes, who was the commissioner, and he made serious attempts to make an improvement. The big improvement when I started was that there was a big to-do about putting more people on probation and parole and less people in prison. So community treatment was the thing at that time. People could clearly see that serving sentences in prisons wasn't working very well, and that we would be better off to try to keep people out as much as we could. So as a probation and parole officer, I tried the best I could to make sure that the people that were under my supervision stayed out. In the mid to later 1970s was the birth of what became known as the persistent felon offender, or the three strikes and you're out. Different states call this different things. And it was sentence enhancement. So sentences became immensely longer. And so by 1980, there were maybe a little over 4,000 inmates. So if you take from 1980 up to 1990, the legislature passed 20 laws that either increased sentences or else created new felonies. This is during a 10-year period. So the prison population, particularly the persistent felony offender inmates, has sentences longer than ever before. That population went through the roof. And so the state legislature continues to pass laws that make it more likely to lock up more people. The most recent example of that is the gang law.
Yeah, could you explain the gang law?
The gang bill, just the prosecutor, if I can prove you're a member of the gang, I can enhance your sentence.
And how do they define a gang?
Well, I think this will primarily be used as a bargaining chip in plea bargains. And this affects primarily people of color. And they rightly called it out for what it is. And it's interesting to think about the origin. Where did the three strikes and your outlaw persistent felony offender statutes come from? In looking around, I found out that the template for these was made by a group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that maybe many of your listeners have heard of. This group was meeting in Texas around in the mid-70s, and if you wanted to be a part of this effort, you had to contribute a substantial amount to the think tank to participate. Mm-hmm. And one of the companies that contributed a substantial amount to participate in this was Corrections Corporation of America, which we now call CoreCivic. So here you have people that have a vested interest in having more inmates participating in making the laws to guarantee that they're going to have more inmates.
Because this is a corporation that runs prisons.
Corrections Corporation of America is now known as CoreCivic. Mm-hmm. CoreCivic is one of the two largest private prison firms in America. The other second largest one is called GEO, which was formerly Wackenhut. Now, there are other corporations as well, but those are the two big ones. And CoreCivic owns the three private prisons in Kentucky. So around the mid-1980s, things got more and more and more crowded. They started to build prisons during the 1980s. They opened up Luther Luckett Correctional Complex right next to the reformatory at LaGrange. They took over Kentucky State Hospital near Danville, Kentucky on Lake Harrington. It was a mental hospital. Now it's known as North Point Correctional Complex. Anyway, it's a prison. And then they started to build other prisons, one of them in Elliott County. And so there was a wave of prison building there. They were opening up a new prison about every 5 years during this period of time. And so in 1986, the state sent for the very first time to a corporation. It was U.S. Corrections Corporation, which was a local corporation at that time. And U.S. Corrections owned what was became known as the Marion Adjustment Center in Marion County. And minimum security inmates were sent down there. And so they paid Kentucky so much per day per inmate. The executive director of that was Clifford Todd, who also owned a private jail facility here in Louisville called River City Corrections. And so Mr. Todd got into an agreement with Richard Fry, the director of the Jefferson County Jail, to make sure that all the beds at River City Corrections would be filled. And so for referring those inmates, Richard Fry would get a set amount per month. This, of course, is illegal. And they were caught and sentenced to prison. So later what happened was is that Corrections Corporation of America bought the U.S. Corrections Corporation prison in Marion County. And then Corrections Corporation of America proceeded to open up other private prisons, one in Lee County, which has started to be used last year about this time. They started to put inmates in there. And now they have 840 or 50 inmates there. And they also opened up at a prison that was known as the Otter Creek Correctional Complex in Floyd County in southeast Kentucky. So these are the three private prisons. These private prisons, and they're all owned by CoreCivic, were used from 1986 up until 2013. And so then there was a break in the inmate population, partly because of some sentencing reforms, and they were able to discontinue the use of the private prisons then. There were lots of problems with the use of private prisons. Private prisons sound like such a good idea that I can do this cheaper if I run it as a business. This sounds a lot like what we heard in 1825. I can do it cheaper.
Yeah, a repeat.
The problems with privatization are not easily understood by the casual observer. But one of the most important aspects of this is that some inmates are cheaper to care for than others. So if I can choose to have the strongest, best inmates come to my private facility, it's going to be cheaper to keep them. So the state will be stuck with inmates that have mental illness, physical illness, maybe they're elderly, which is a growing problem, and any behavior problems. So those inmates end up staying at the state. So there were serious issues that took place during the 29 years or so that the state used private prisons. One was staffing. These prisons are built way out in the country, and they're seen as major economic development projects. Well, what this means is that you don't have any African-American population out there. And these are more distant from populated areas, so it's harder for people to visit. Mm-hmm. But not only that, there were inmates from other states that were put into these private prisons along with Kentucky inmates. And this proved to be very problematic. Vermont did this with 400 inmates and put them into the Lee Adjustment Center, the Corrections Corporation facility, and those inmates had a riot. And they had a riot because the place was not really probably adequately staffed. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of issues and investigative reports written, and they're lucky that nobody was killed in the process. So Vermont took those inmates back. For the Otter Creek facility, the main thing that went wrong down there with inmates from other states at Otter Creek and Floyd County is that Hawaii sent quite a number of women inmates there.
Hawaii.
Ugh. The cost to keep inmates in Hawaii is really high. And so these women were sent to southeast Kentucky to be in the Otter Creek Correctional Facility. I mean, this amounts to like the gulag. You ship your inmates far away as possible from their family. And then you have staff that is low paid. And that's the major way you save money with prisons, is on personnel costs. And so they were inadequately staffed, and there were indictments and convictions for rape. More than one. There were a number of them. Mm-hmm. And the end result of that was that Hawaii pulled its inmates out of that prison and sent them to another core civic prison in Arizona or New Mexico or
something. So does that still go on? We still take prisoners from out of state?
Well, the private corporations own these prisons. They can do whatever they want.
Is there any oversight?
Well, there is oversight. But just like the oversight that took place in the 1800s, just because there's oversight doesn't mean there's action that results from it. Mm-hmm. So we have these private prisons waiting. The other main part of this, and I should have referred to this earlier, is that during the later 1980s, the state started to contract with county jails to keep inmates. So the state will pay a county jail so much per inmate per day. So in effect, the state is acting as a broker to send inmates to county jails. And the county jails are profiting so much per day per inmate by keeping state inmates. And so where we are today is that 45%, more than 11,000 inmates, and in December 2017, it was like 12,000 inmates, were in the county jails in Kentucky. Kentucky elects jailers. These jailers have an association. They have a lobbyist. The lobbyist's name is on the report about state inmates in county jails, is offering assistance. The head of the Kentucky Jailers Association, she's a lobbyist. She can be a lobbyist and the president of the Kentucky Jailers Association at the same time.
The county jails are private? Are they private?
The county jails are not private, but they are being used as private. Uh-huh. Because the state is contracting with them as if they were.
Oh, okay.
So much per inmate per day. Much cheaper than keeping them in the state prison. Because the average for a state prisoner per day is around $70 per day. If you keep an inmate in the county jail, it's like between $30 and $40 per day. So the counties make money on having inmates. And so there's not been a new state prison opened up since 2005. But the expansion in the county jails has been astronomical. So you have huge new jails, the most obvious one of which is right out there in Buckner, Kentucky, right near the state reformatory. It's the new Oldham County Jail. It's huge. So you now have 11,000 of the state inmates that are being housed in county jails. These are facilities without much space to have treatment or recreation. They're overcrowded. The state does have jail inspectors, but who's going to care? I mean, where's the enforcement? If the conditions are inadequate, they're written up, but there doesn't necessarily have to be action that follows from that. So in addition to these 11,000 inmates that are state felons, you have another 12,000 inmates that are in these county jails for lesser offenses, misdemeanor offenses, maybe awaiting trial. So almost half of the state's inmate population is housed in county jails, and this is cheaper, and these are what I regard as inhumane conditions. And so this is where we are today. So the county jails hate the private prisons because they compete for inmates. And so here you have like a spreading around of the jobs. These are economic development projects. Mm-hmm. For the counties. Mm-hmm. And so you have about 79 county jails now, and these people have immense power. And it is very hard to get this group of people to do anything because they're elected officials, and they don't mind telling you that. Mm-hmm. They're not stupid. Mm-hmm. And many of them are doing a great job in horrible conditions. Almost to a person, these are always interesting, smart people. Mm-hmm. Not always, but most of the time. But there is a vested interest, so they hire and fire and control, and this brings money into the county. Mm-hmm. So if the state starts to take inmates out of these jails, there is a political unhappiness. And none of this that I've talked about today has anything to do with the 7,000 federal inmates that are in prisons in Kentucky. These are all additional. You have three main federal prisons in Kentucky, one at Ashland, one at Manchester, and one at Lexington. And then you have two smaller prison camps, and these hold almost 7,000 inmates. Federal inmates are less than 10% of the inmates in America. Kentucky has a high percentage of those inmates for a state its size.
Wow.
And that's because Hal Rogers is very good at snatching prisons for East Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So that's how the prison came to be at Manchester, and there's another one that's being built. So prisons are seen as economic development projects.
Are they residents of Kentucky who are in these federal prisons?
No.
Or do they come... They come from all over
the
country?
The federal prisoners ship people all over.
Huh.
The feds have much more ability to send people wherever they want. One of the main federal prisons in Kentucky is a medical facility. It's the one in Lexington. It was built in the mid-30s. It was known as the Narcotics Farm. It was the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital where they did all that, what today would be illegal experimentation with drugs.
Is that right?
So
they experimented on prisoners?
They did.
Huh.
There's a video about this on I've seen it on educational TV. They would give inmates LSD and see what happened. This was a public health service hospital, and it was built right in the middle of the Depression. It came to be known as the narcotics farm.
Huh. But not because people were there for drug crimes.
A lot of people went there for drug crimes.
Did they?
But now it's a medical facility for the federal prisoners that have medical needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the state reformatory at Kentucky is becoming. You have more and more inmates with higher and higher medical needs. And so the state's going to have the real expensive inmates. Some of these contracts with the private prisons have guaranteed occupancy. So that if you don't keep a certain number of inmates there, you're going to have to pay for the beds anyway. So it might be that the state would be forced to take inmates out of its own prison and put there so that this is possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it'll happen. So this is why I'm stepping out to be active again.
Yeah, because it just doesn't seem to have any connection at all with reducing the number of prisoners in our prisons and also reducing the number of crimes.
The assumption society makes is that there's a lot more crimes than there used to be. Mm-hmm. And on a per capita basis, this isn't really true. And so the length of sentences is the main change. That's the main reason that we have the population explosion that we do, mm-hmm. is that you have vastly increased sentences. It's like the Willie Horton ad goes on forever. Mm-hmm. It's easy to exploit people's fears and get elected. You know, when I started as a parole officer in 1972, a life sentence might be no more than 6 or 7 years served behind bars. Now it's very common for people to get sentences of 5 times that. And so inmates are serving longer and longer sentences than ever before. And so you have more and more and more people on probation and parole than ever before, more than 50,000 people. So if you start to add up 36,000 people in county jails, plus 12,000 people in the state prisons, plus 7,000 people in the federal prisons, plus, depends on how you add the numbers up, around somewhere between 50 and 65,000 people on various forms of supervision.
In the state of Kentucky.
In Kentucky. Yeah. So you start to add this up, pretty soon you start to approach like 100,000. So now you have huge numbers of people that are affected by this, and you have 312,000 people in Kentucky who can't vote because of felony offenses. Well, this is 9% of the population. And so from 1970, you have, like, say, 3,000 inmates. Today, you have 25,000. So we've had 800% increase, mm-hmm. or if you take from 1980, about 600% increase, mm-hmm. in the prison population during that time period. So you have, like, probably the highest per capita incarceration rate ever. And in fact, Kentucky is the 7th highest incarceration rate in the United States.
And it has less to do with more crimes being committed and more to do with longer prison sentences.
Yes. So people would argue that there's less crime than there used to be because we're keeping more people incarcerated. But I would argue that you have 50, 60,000 people on probation and parole that are out. Mm-hmm. And so you have a huge number of people that are out, and that the quality of the vocational training and educational aspects has declined more than it has ever been for a really long time. There is less money spent on that. And the prison industries of today, they are state use, but they might only employ 700 people. So what I fully expect is for factories to move into prison walls again.
Because that's the direction that we're headed.
Yes, and I'm concerned that the governor might start to move factories into the state prisons. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's still problematic to sell goods across the state line, mm-hmm. but you can just sell them to a shell company right here in Louisville someplace, and then they can sell them out of state. There's going to be a new rise in prison industries, and this is coincides with the decline of labor unions. So the whole issue of prison labor is rapidly coming to the front burner again. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that free labor has forgotten. That might be a problem for them. I mean, this is costing the taxpayer in the neighborhood of $600 million a year, and I think this is very important because the main thing is that the public is sleeping through this, and it happens to other people, not us. And we need an army of people to ask questions about these things. So these are the issues. This is the way I see it.
Is there any way for people to contact you?
They could email me at tkyleellison@gmail.com.
Well, thank you, Kyle. This has been very, very educational and disturbing, and I really appreciate the knowledge and experience you bring.
Well, thank you for having me.
That does it for this edition of Reach Out in the Darkness. Stay tuned for Ethics Forward with your host, Avery Kohlers.